the Caronites. Chairman of the board, Shane Peterson, is over there. News boss Frank Shires is over here. And I am Mike Lewis, sometimes way out there. Tonight, we are going to talk about snow days. We're going to talk about judicial appointments, bomb-sniffing rats, and how to die in a healthy way. Seriously. Oh, and pay attention. It looks like a nice week next week, so plan accordingly. Maybe a sick day or two. The president has decided that he is going to nominate Federal Appeals Court Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court tomorrow. She formerly taught at Notre Dame, where Carter Sneed is also a professor. He knows her personally. So CBS News asked him about the concerns people have about her conservative views.
For those who are concerned about Judge Barrett, I can assure them that there's no way in which her personal views will ever enter into her decision making. And she will do her level best with an open mind and a brilliant mind, which has been widely recognized both by folks across the ideological spectrum, that she will do her level best to find the right answer.
Yeah, and the good news for you also, folks, is that coming up in the show at 8 o'clock, we're going to be talking to Amy Howe. Amy Howe is an attorney and a writer for what's called the SCOTUS blog, Supreme Court of the United States blog. It is a fantastic nonpartisan website that just does analysis of what cases people have heard, how they have decided, what their tendencies are. She did a phenomenal portrait on Justice, or rather Judge Barrett. And it explains in great detail, like, this is what the conservatives love about her. This is what the liberals are fearful of. It is absolutely worth a listen to listen to Amy talk about it. That is coming up at 8 o'clock. The 48-year-old judge will begin meeting with key senators as early as Wednesday, and hearings could start within weeks.
Since taking her seat on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals 3 years ago, Amy Coney Barrett has ruled on two abortion cases, both times siding with placing restrictions on access to abortions. She has previously stated that Roe v. Wade is settled law. But at the same time, she seems to believe that restrictions on abortions, especially on the grounds of religious liberty, is not unconstitutional.
That's actually fairly similar to the position that Brett Kavanaugh has taken. The president apparently plans to announce this on Saturday, that she's his choice. He is not known to have interviewed, according to sources within the administration, he is not known to have interviewed any other candidates. And he came away from 2 days of meetings with Judge Barrett, really impressed with her as a jurist. And essentially the way he described her and the way people in his administration described her, she was described as a female Antonin Scalia. And that is actually who she clerked for. And if you listen to the interview later, it's her academic career is pretty impressive. She was a full professor by the time she was 30 years old at Notre Dame. And she was three-time, I think, professor of the year in the Notre Dame Law School, really well-regarded. I realize her conservative views are probably not aligned with where mine are, but nonetheless, she was apparently also neck and neck with Brett Kavanaugh during that election, and the president apparently told people he wanted to save her just in case Justice Ginsburg did not complete her term, and it turns out the late Justice Ginsburg, in fact, didn't. And so this is who he had in the wheelhouse to nominate. It's going to be interesting to see if the nomination, though, can get done in essentially about 38 days, I think, once the process begins. The fastest, and again, you'll hear more on this in the interview later today, the fastest turnaround, according to Amy Howe with the SCOTUS blog, she says that was 60 days, and that actually was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ruth Bader Ginsburg also had very little. She had questioning opposition, but when it came down to a vote, it was widely in favor of her. I don't expect that this one is going to be anywhere near as close. But if that took 60 days, and that was the fastest yet, if that took 60 days and this has 38 days, it's going to be pretty difficult to get a hearing done prior to the election. And it's not entirely clear from a political standpoint if the president even wants to make this happen before. I think what I've been told that the president is interested in, at least by people who analyze these sort of things, is that he definitely wants to get the ball rolling. whether or not they want to move it through prior to the election. I think that they will be sensitive to the fact that there are people who actually, it seems like in the last couple of polls, a majority of people feel like the next president, whomever that is, should be able to pick the justice. But my guess is that this is the likely person going to be put in the court regardless. There is really, if he loses the election, there is zero liability in him pushing this through and the Senate pushing this through anyway past the election. So I don't see, and if he wins, of course, it's going to be pushed through. So I don't see why they wouldn't still push this through post-election. Getting it done pre-election is going to put a lot of pressure on the system in a manner that would be pretty unprecedented between now and that, just in unprecedented in terms of the number of days it would take to move it through. But we'll see. On to the other story. We hinted about this early on. Unfortunately, if your kids are listening, while there's nothing about this that is in any way obscene, it is just desperately sad news for kids all in all northern states across the country.
The end of the snow day in New York City. That's right. There'll be no snow days in public schools this year. That's because nearly all students will have some kind of remote learning capability. So with the school start delayed, the city's concerned it still needs to meet the 180-day instruction requirement under state funding guidelines.
Wow. So that's a devastating news to kids who were expecting a snow day or two. Certainly, if you grew up in places like Michigan or Wisconsin, if you grew up in Ohio or New York State, if you grew up in Pennsylvania, you had your share of snow days. And in fact, other states as well. But those states get an enormous amount of snow. Montana, Idaho, even Seattle has its snow days every year, primarily because we don't snow that much, but we can't do much about it when it does actually happen. And in fact, I've always told my friends who don't live in this area that one of the great things about living up here is it's one of the few places in the country where an adult gets a snow day. But that is unlikely to happen. I think at your work, if you're even going into work anymore, you're not going to get a snow day because you've already been doing remote learning. Well, it applies to your kids as well. And I think that for kids, what a drag, because a snow day is like, I don't know, as an adult, you never reach into a pocket and find an extra 20 or something like that, and it always feels like such a bonus, even though it is your money, you just lost it. This is the way a snow day always feels like. It's that one, it's a prize. And if it comes on a test day or some other day that you're nervous about when you're a kid, wow, what a treat. And now that we put this whole apparatus in place for remote learning, and my guess is that, you know, once we roll through at least the early part of winter, we're still going to be seeing a lot of remote learning, although some of the school districts are opening up. The kids there, well, they are not going to get snow days anymore because we managed to do effective, well, or I guess that's arguable. We managed to at least put distance learning apparatus in place, some more effective than others, but it looks like that's going to be the default. And so your snow day is not going to be a day of hot chocolate and snowball fights and sledding. It's just going to be a little bit more school at a greater distance. And finally, in this top of the hour, let's talk a little bit about Florida. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis today decided to open the state up entirely. They're referring to it as moving into phase three, where there would be little or no restrictions on the dining industry. Here you go.
In the state of Florida, we are today moving into what we initially called phase three.
And this is the governor of Florida. Oops.
And what that'll mean for the restaurants is that there will not be limitations from the state of Florida. And in fact, we're also cognizant about the need for business certainty. There have been some local closures and other types of restrictions. And so the order that I'm signing today will guarantee restaurants operate, will not allow closures. They can operate at a minimum of 50% regardless of local rule. And then if a local restricts between 50 and 100, they've got to provide the justification and they've got to identify what the costs are involved with doing that are.
And here's a bit more from CBS News correspondent Manuel Bajorquez.
The governor cited a positivity rate for new cases below 5% in his push to reopen the economy. But other estimates have that figure at about 11%, which is much higher than many health officials recommend to reopen.
So Florida right now is having a bit of a small spike in coronavirus cases, but it's not as bad as it was. So if you go back to Florida in August, it was getting, the 7-day average was 11,000 new cases. It has since gone down to September 22nd. The 7-day average was 2,000 cases. So it's definitely seen a decline from the peak in mid-July to August. That's when it was at its highest. And that's why the governor has decided to relax the order. Under the order, he said municipalities must justify, so local governments, that would be state and county governments, must justify any local restrictions of restaurant capacity between 50 and 100%. It does not force municipalities to increase capacities in bars beyond 50%. So if you're a bar owner there, you can stick with your 50% standard, but local municipalities cannot, under the state restriction, cannot actually reduce it beyond that. If that county is having a spike in infections, well, then it's a spike in infections, and the restaurant can make its own decision about what it wants to do. This whole situation in Florida is getting very interesting. It's getting fraught. There's public officials in both Georgia and Alabama who are a little bit concerned about this, given that they have a little bit tighter restrictions. And, you know the way it is. If you've lived on the eastern part of Washington State or near the Oregon border, there's a lot of cross-state transit from people delivering stuff, people going to dinner, all of that sort of normal activity that happens when you're right at a state line or at a border. This is a concern when the state next to you unleashes or releases all of the restrictions in that state. It's going to be, I think, interesting for the restaurants and bars and the general public, because, I mean, this is the reality in Washington State as well. And I was part of a group of people who signed a petition to push for bars to be open at least a little bit later than they are now. The governor in Washington State has said, and this appears to track with what the CDC says in terms of spreader events, even slight spreader events, not necessarily giant gatherings, but they essentially target gymnasiums, bars, and restaurants as being the three primary places where people seem to come in contact. Now, I have, and in fact, a bunch of you texted in, like, where is the actual data on that? I know from a national standpoint, the CDC has provided some of that data, and it seems, I don't know whether you can extrapolate all of that exactly, but it seems at least plausible. It is where people gather. There are other places where people gather, but they don't sit in as much proximity. I mean, they gather in stores and they gather in other. This is why churches actually were a part of this whole thing, although it's not necessarily true in many states that you can still go back to large gatherings in churches. I've driven past funeral homes here in Seattle, and I've seen people, it looked like a hazmat meeting. People are dressed, fully dressed in gear before they're going into actually funeral, and funerals are also very, very limited on how many people you can have there. Restaurants and bars have been perceived as one of those places, particularly in places like Florida and in Arizona, in Texas and in California, where you have big crowds, you have warm weather, so people aren't wearing much anyway. They're disinclined because of the sweaty weather to put on their masks, and so you have these events where a lot of people seem to get infected. But the DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who's you know, very much a strong supporter of the president, feels like if you look at the mortality rates, not necessarily the people who get sick or maybe get permanently sick from this, but if you look at the mortality rates, setting aside the 200,000 people in the United States who have died from it and the other group of people we don't know that may have died from, or at least that and other complications, the mortality rate has still not been as high as I think he feels like it needs to be for the states to keep on those restrictions. And so we're going to see Florida as an experiment, if you will. It is going to be interesting to see if Florida pulls these restrictions. Let's see. So according to the New York Times, as of Friday evening, there have been 695,000 cases and 13,000 deaths in Florida since the beginning of the pandemic, according to the New York Times database. It is the biggest county. Leon County is one of the worst in Florida, but the numbers clearly are the new deaths numbers seem to indicate that the infection rate may even be higher than those numbers itself. But what we're going to find is that once we start seeing what happens in Florida, I think nationally, I think the feds will be taking a close look at this as well. You're going to find either, I don't know if you're going to find Florida reversing its order. The governor said emphatically, we're not going back. We're going ahead with this, and we're going to leave it, essentially return to business as usual right now. My guess is that that order can always be rescinded if they do get an unusual level of spike or a real increase in the number of fatalities. But if they don't, I think you're going to start seeing other states following suit. Unlikely out here in the West Coast, but I think in the South region around there, when you're looking at the Carolinas and you're looking at Georgia and when you're looking at Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, those are states that have been much more inclined to be sort of politically aligned with and socially aligned with Florida. So if we start seeing Florida, you know, unleash, it's going to be, I think, a domino effect down there. And then we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, the weird thing is I'm not rooting against Florida here. If Florida takes off its restrictions and nothing bad happens, I think that's fantastic. That's great news. I mean, mainly you just want to see us get a handle on this thing and people not get sick and people not get dying, people not be debilitated, especially people who have no insurance. I think that that would be a dynamite outcome. So if they're going to roll the dice and if they end up winning with rolling those dice, more power to them as far as I'm concerned. I just don't want to see more people get sick. Coming up in the next hour, speaking of such, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jim DeMaine. He is a former professor, retired professor from the University of Washington Medical School. His book, Facing Death, is a fascinating look into how we can prepare ourselves to have, and the way his terminology, how the way we can have a healthy death. It is absolutely worth listening to. Coming up after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. This has been, I think by anyone's estimation, a year where we've dealt with a lot of death. 200,000 people now have died from coronavirus. But this isn't about coronavirus as much as it is about the way we approach death. And can death actually be a healing process? We're joined now with Jim DeMaine. He's a doctor. He was a pulmonary critical care specialist and a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington. And his new book, Facing Death, talks about the way we approach death. Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this book is remarkable in the way it approaches this idea of death as not being something to be. I mean, obviously, we're all scared of it. And obviously, it's, you know, that's the one of the things that we all have in common is we're going to get there someday.
Right.
Tell for the folks who aren't as familiar with this idea, tell us a little bit. Give us a synopsis of your book or give the listeners a synopsis of your book, which I thoroughly am enjoying.
Well, thank you. The book is really a book of stories because that's kind of the way I think. I started writing these down after I retired, and I think people learn from stories, seeing what other people have done, how they've handled death and dying within their families, and how to have a conversation, how to listen intently, how to handle conflicts, what options are at the end. All these things I dealt with over the years. I would deal with it daily in my life in critical care, and found that a lot of people, when they got to that point, it was like deer in the headlights. They'd never had a conversation. They'd never really thought about the end. William Saran says, everybody has got to die, but I always believe an exception would be made in my case. I think, you know, denial is good. You know, we need to get on with our everyday lives for sure. But I think periodically we need to step back and really seriously think about it. And my hope is that we can begin to have more conversation about what death means to us and what matters the most around that time. In other words, how would we envision a good death for ourselves? And then how can we find an advocate? How can we communicate our wishes? And most importantly, how can we make sure that once we maybe fill out all the forms and everything, how can we be sure that people are going to pay attention, you know, when that time comes?
We're talking with Dr. Jim DeMaine, his new book, Facing Death. This is from a lifetime of clinical work with people who are facing death. Jim, how did you decide on who it is that you selected, the stories you selected for this particular book?
Well, there's multiple stories. I wanted to feature both people that really did good planning and then some problem situations, and also where there were some conflicts, because that's reality. I mean, things don't always go smoothly at that time because emotions run high, particularly if there's conflict in families, if there's drug abuse, or if there's alcoholism, or, you know, some kind of dysfunctional atmosphere, then things can flare up. So I wanted to point out all kinds of different stories. And so it's really a number of vignettes with a little lesson that's implied in each one, trying to get us to think and, again, picture for ourselves what that might be like.
Well, what did you – first, let me ask another question. Jim, how old are you?
I am now 81, almost 82.
82. You sound great, but – what are these things, when you hear these stories from people, I mean, this book is not just about their stories, but it's also, to a degree, how it's shaped your own view of the end of your life. What did these people who you talked to and the stories that you include in the book, how did they affect you?
Well, quite a bit. You know, when I go back and think about medical school, we were never taught about death and dying. If somebody had cancer, we weren't even supposed to tell them that. You know, denial and hiding was kind of the way we approached that. I think society has opened up more. We're willing to talk about it more. And I really gradually learned over time. My patients actually taught me lessons about the way they coped with their own deaths. I had one lady that had severe pulmonary hypertension. She was Asian descent from Guam initially, and she had just a very philosophical outlook on life. She got very, very ill at one point. I was suggesting that she go over to the University of Washington for a lung transplant. And she said, no, I really don't want to do that. I'm in the Lord's hands, and whatever happens, happens. And I had her husband come in because I was kind of worried that they might not understand, but they did. She went off to Guam with oxygen and everything to visit family before she died and sent me a nice postcard saying she was doing okay. But when she came back, she was very ill and was placed into hospice care. And I was beginning to lose track of her, except I would get notes from the hospice team. And then one day, the team called me up and said, you know, she would really like you to stop by the house. She really wants to see you once again. And so I left and knocked on the front door. This is over in Bellevue. And it's a very nice home in a modest neighborhood. And I could hear music coming from inside. And I said, my gosh, what's this? And so grandchild answered the door and called for his grandpa. And I walked in, and there were young kids running all around the house. And the table was just piled with food. And there was my patient in a hospital bed right in the middle of all this, oxygen running, sleepy smile on her face. She was getting morphine given by the family just to help her control her symptoms, you know, all under the direction of the hospice nurses. And she just held my hand. She said, Dr. DeMaine, you must be tired. Why don't you get something to eat? So she was kind of taking care of me.
And wow.
Patients like that just taught me so much about the grace and beauty that we can pass on to our family if we can approach death with that kind of equanimity. Now, all the stories in the book obviously aren't that beautiful. I mean, there are others where people fought it up until the end or had post-traumatic stress problems that flared up. I mean, all kinds of issues come up. But I try to bring up these points in stories. And at the end of the book, for people that really want to proceed with their own planning, I have frequently asked questions that direct people to websites and resources in the community, you know, where they can actually do specific planning that there's very good books and websites that I note in that appendix to the book.
We're talking with Dr. Jim DeMaine. He was a pulmonary critical care specialist with Group Health. He also was a clinical professor of medicine. He's now a professor emeritus at the University of Washington School of Medicine. His new book, Facing Death, Finding Dignity, Hope, and Healing at the End. Jim, do you have any book signings, any events coming up where people can maybe see you at least on a Zoom call and learn a little bit more about your book and about your blog?
Yeah, thanks. My blog, first of all, is just endoflifeblog.com. And on that, I will list the events coming up. But the most immediate one is next Wednesday. We were going to do it on Tuesday, but that's the debate night for the election.
Oh, right.
So Wednesday at Brick and Mortar Books over in Redmond, 7 p.m. will be the link to the Zoom. It's on their website, and it's also on my website. And then there'll be an interview at Town Hall on November 16th with Katie Sewell. That might be well worth tuning into. And that, of course, will be on Town Hall's website. And then there's others as well, as you might imagine, that are coming up, and those will be posted on my website.
That was Jim DeMaine, Dr. Jim DeMaine, and his book, Facing Death, Finding Dignity, Hope, and Healing at the End. Jim, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Thank you, Mike. Much appreciated.
And coming up in the next hour, we are going to be talking, well, of course, we're going to be talking with Stacey Jo Ross, but we're also going to be talking to an expert on the new Supreme Court nominee, someone who did a lengthy profile on her, and what we know about why conservatives love her and why the Democrats are a little bit scared, coming up after the hour. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I don't know about you folks, but I think I found, given just the fire hose of news, much of it unhappy news over the course of the last few months, I think we're all turning to other things. And, you know, you've seen not just from staying home, but I think also just from distraction, Netflix, people are binging on Netflix. You know, one of my favorite things, weirdly enough, has been animal videos. I don't know why. I didn't used to watch a lot of them. I watch them all the time now. Well, the happy ones anyway. And it's been particular on the website, the Dodo. And this is what got me thinking about it. One of the things I really dig about it. So if you had to go into subsets of animal videos, let's just say, you know, either cats or dogs or what have you, whatever it is that you really enjoy, I'd like cross species friendship videos the most. Within the genre of animal videos, those are always particularly fun to watch and particularly cute. Well, this is a little bit like that. Although this friendship, I guess, would be between some landmine investigators and a giant pouched rat. And this is from NPR. For the first time, one of Britain's highest animal honors has been awarded to a rat. This is a rat that has been trained to sniff out long abandoned landmines. Apparently, there are still thousands of them in Cambodia, in the rural areas of Cambodia. And this rat is believed to have saved hundreds and hundreds of lives. This is Jackie Fox from RTE News. More on Magawa, the landmine sniffing rat.
The 7-year-old rodent has been trained to detect the mines by the charity Apopo, and during his career, he has helped clear the equivalent of 20 football pitches of mines. He is capable of searching a field the size of a tennis court in just 20 minutes, something that would take a person with a metal detector between 1 and 4 days. Scouring the land, Magawa has the ability to identify a chemical compound within the explosives and is small and light enough that he doesn't trigger mines if he walks over them. Once he finds them, he scratches the top to alert his human co-workers, who have become very fond of him.
And so here is the in the United Kingdom, the veterinary charity PDSA's Director General Jan McLaughlin on her awarding Magawa for his masterful work.
Now, a prize for his work. The UK veterinary charity PDSA has presented him with its gold medal for life-saving bravery and devotion to duty.
Magawa is a true hero rat, and we're thrilled to celebrate his life-saving devotion by awarding him the PDSA gold medal. Magawa's medal has been specially designed to fit onto his work harness, so he can wear it any time.
Magawa has sniffed out 39 landmines and 28 unexploded munitions in his career. He's now nearing retirement age, but leaving as the leader of his rat pack.
I gotta say, I particularly like this story. I like rats getting a little bit better PR from time to time. And this one, and if you've not seen it, this is a story worth looking up, because this rat, this giant, it's like a almost like a small kangaroo. I think it's still classified as a rat. It's a pouched rat. It is not a marsupial, as far as I know. But they're born in Tanzania, and apparently they have unbelievably sensitive noses. That's the way they do most of their hunting and most of their finding of food. And so they trained this one specifically for these explosives. My guess is that we're going to start seeing drug rats at some point in airports all over the country, and probably on ports as well. These are the kind of stories that I really, really enjoy, mainly because it also lets us know the other thing, and the other side of the coin, of course, is this, is the issue with landmines in Southeast Asia. There still are literally thousands of them scattered about in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in Laos. It has been a problem for many, many years. And while we've removed thousands, we have also left thousands. And those aren't the only areas where we've left them. That's one of the areas where they're still having many problems. Every year, people, kids, step on one, lose a limb, sometimes get killed. So it's really nice to see that we've found a way both to get rats a little bit of good publicity, and to also be able to clear out these landmines safely. So hats off to Magawa. A pretty terrific story. Coming up in the next hour, this is an interview you're really going to want to listen to, regardless of your political persuasion. If you're interested in what goes on in the Supreme Court, look at the SCOTUS blog. It's a Supreme Court of the United States blog called SCOTUS blog. It is straight down the middle, excellent research, nonpartisan, and its profile of the potential next justice on the Supreme Court from Amy Howe is terrific. We interview Amy Howe during the next half hour, and we're going to talk to her a lot about what is it that conservatives love so much about this potential justice, and what is it that Democrats are so worried about, and are we going to get a confirmation pre-election? Coming up right after the break.